Okay, hello everyone, I'm Seth Stasinski with the Office of National Coordinator for Health IT. I wanna thank you for joining the Public Health Data Systems Task Force meeting today. We have a number of presenters with us today, and wanna thank everyone for participating, including the members of our task force. As a reminder, all task force meetings are open to the public, and your public feedback is welcomed throughout the meeting during the Zoom chat feature and then during the public comment period that will be taking place towards the end of our call at 11:50 Eastern time this morning. We'll start off with a roll call of the task force members. So when I say your name, if you could please indicate your presence. I'll start off with our task force co-chairs, Jillian Haney.
Present, good morning.
Morning. Aria Malik.
Good morning.
Rachel Bolton.
I'm here.
Thank you. Hans Butendijk.
Good morning.
Morning. Heather Cook Sinclair. Aaron Holt Cohn.
Good morning.
Morning. Charles Cross.
Here.
Morning. Steve Eichner.
Good morning. Present.
Morning. Joe Gibson.
Good morning.
Morning. Raj Gitvardi.
Good morning.
Jim Jurgis.
Good morning.
John Kansky.
Good morning.
Morning. Bryant Thomas Karras.
I'm here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Stephen Lane. Jennifer Layden. Leslie Leonard. Hung Liu.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mark Mawastika.
Present. Good morning.
Good morning. Aaron Meary. Alex Muggy. Stephen Murphy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Elia Oliveria.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Jamie Pina.
Present. Good morning.
Good morning. Abby Sears.
Good morning.
Good morning. Vivian Singletary.
Good morning.
Phil Sutherland.
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. And Cheryl Turney. All right. Anyone I missed need to announce themselves, or anyone who's come on since we started? All right, thank you everybody. I'll turn it over to our co-chairs, Arian and Jillian, to get the meeting started.
All right, today we're gonna get an overview of HL7 Public Health Workgroup, as well as an important view into public health law. I think we've had some good conversations about minimum necessary and you know how we better balance the need for privacy and security and also the need of covered entities to meet their standard under minimum necessary and meet the public health mission. So we're going to have a good conversation there. And then, as usual, we're going to try to spend the majority of our time digging through our recommendations to date, both on the spreadsheet and also introducing the draft transmittal. Try to conclude as usual with our public comment, but we don't have that much more time to go before our final report out. So it is it's time to dig into the details and make sure that we flush through everything that exists in the worksheet and get that over into the transmittal so that we have a good transmittal draft. But with that, I will turn it over to Jillian to lead us through our panel discussions.
Great, thanks, Arian. I think the only thing I would add is if we could also, before we get to the worksheet, just talk a little bit about the parameters around the transmittal document and how it's going to be used and access to it. So we'll put that in the parking lot until we get there. So thank you very much to Stephen Murphy and Craig Newman to coming and giving us a presentation this morning. I mean, Arianne's already mentioned what will be covered, so I think we can just get right to it. Craig, you are up first. So just as an FYI, the HL7 Public Health Work Group is the entity that facilitates publishing of the HL7 standards for public health. So welcome, Craig.
All right, thank you. And I apologize in advance. I'm also sitting in a hotel, so unfamiliar wireless and sound, and downtown Tacoma is surprisingly noisy, so apologize in advance. All right, so I was asked to bring a presentation to this group about the HL7 Public Health Work Group, present that perspective. It was a relatively long list of potential topics to cover in 5 minutes. So I'm going to try and keep things fairly brief and then assume if you have specific questions that we'll cover them in a discussion, or you can then just ask. So if you can go to the next slide, what I'll just remind folks, as Gillian mentioned, the Public Health Work Group is a part of the HL7 Standards Development Organization, and we are a volunteer group. So we do not, for the most part, as a work group, create the standards, but we sponsor project teams that come to us with defined projects in mind, help them through the process of creating, validating, and publishing an HL7 guide. We do our best to guide them and make sure that things are consistent between projects, but the work group as an entity is really there as a forum as much as anything. And so over the years, we've developed a really broad range of different standards that covers a lot of ground. Just most of them are presented here. This includes a lot of the core specifications that are represented in EHR certification requirements and regulations today, the things that you're all familiar with: case reporting, syndromic, cancer, healthcare surveys, laboratory orders and results, healthcare associated infections. And one you'll notice that's missing from here is actually the immunization standard, which is not currently an HL7 published standard, but a lot of the same people that participate in the work group have had a hand in that document as well, myself included. But the work group is much broader than that. We have standards in a large number of other areas. There's a large number, that center column is really a lot that deal directly with maternal and child health, which is one of the priorities that we're hearing a lot about in public health today. But we also touch on areas such as occupational data, situational awareness, which has been critical for the combating the COVID pandemic, obviously, referrals, and then we do have some immunization work, and we are actually working now towards the standardization of some of the building blocks that are common between a lot of reporting programs. And one thing to notice here is that we have a wide variety of topics, but also of approaches. In parentheses are the HL7 product families that are represented in some of these areas. And you'll notice that it's a very split mix. There is a lot of HL7 version 2, there's a lot of CDA-based guides, and now as a community, we're also looking a lot into fire, as is most of healthcare. So a very diverse group of standards and a lot of different ways of approaching public health data sharing. You can go to the next slide. I thought I would just end really with what we have found works in public health over the last probably decade or more, really, is that the HL7 consensus process for creating standards works, right? We're a very active work group. We have a lot of participation. We are largely US-centric. That's who shows up to the calls. But for the purposes of this group, that's probably all right. But we do get a lot of input from public health, from EHR vendors. We've undertaken a lot of outreach over the last few years to make sure that EHRs are represented within our work group, because they're a valuable and necessary partner, and we want to hear them. And that we've also found that the inclusions of standards in EHR certification requirements has really driven adoption by the HIT vendors, not a surprise. And that naming standards in programs such as meaningful use originally and promoting interoperability drives implementation in the real world. These have been very successful programs for seeing adoption, right? The immunization world, if you're familiar with that, is a great example of how we've driven adoption of a standard across the country. But the main thing that we wanted to bring, I think, is that we need to continue to raise that bar, right? We have the core standards that are in certification. We have those are largely represented in other regulations, but there's so much more that we can do, right? And that this is a really important driver for public health. And so again, as I mentioned, maternal and child health is a gigantic topic. It is a priority for a lot of people. And we have standards that have existed in some cases for many years that just have never gotten the traction that they need in the real world. Things like newborn screening, birth defect reporting, birth certification, which underlies a lot of other public health programs. So there's a lot more that we can do. But as we do that, we need to be clear on what the requirements are. We need to be as exact as possible. We understand the dangers of being too prescriptive, but we've learned in the past that ambiguity is not our friend. And so we need to be careful with our standards and how we reference them to be as exact as possible. And we want to make sure that people understand there's, we have to adopt the right technology and architectures, right? I know the world is focused on FHIR, but version 2 and CDA are mature standards. Public health understands them, and they are very well suited to certain public health workflows. And so we shouldn't overlook those in favor of the new and shiny thing always. FHIR may gives us a lot more tools, but it may not always be the right answer. And we really want to focus on ways to augment the flow of data that's happening today. We don't want to rip and replace things that are working just to replace them with a FHIR solution, right? We want to be looking to expand, not replace. And then we need to have public health reflected in USCDI. We need to promote USCDI Plus so that public health needs are front and center there. We need to coordinate activities across agencies. We see a lot of input from CDC, ONC, PIRSA to a lesser extent within the work group. Those activities need to be coordinated. And really the important thing, the take-home message, is that support for implementation needs to be coordinated across all partners. Healthcare providers, public health, community organizations, all need to have similar resources and expectations in terms of what their systems can do, how well they conform to the standards. We need to think of it across all partners within public health. Historically, meaningful use, promoting interoperability, and some of the funding programs have focused on one side, but not necessarily the other in unison. And we need to change that so that expectation and resources are available on both sides so that we can all work together. Last slide is just the summary. If you have questions, happy to answer them. You can always reach out to me or any of the public health work group chairs, or you can just join the calls. We meet every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern, and we invite everybody to join us. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Craig. I really appreciate your perspective from the work group, and I think your point particularly around version 2 and CDA, not to overlook those, I think is important, particularly in light of the really vast difference of resources and capability across public health. Not everybody is going to be able to manage FHIR at this time. So thank you for that. Our next presenter is Stephen Murphy from the Center or the Network for Public Health Law. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks very much, Jillian, and good morning, everybody. I want to just thank the task force for giving me the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I'm Stephen Murphy, a senior public health attorney with the Network for Public Health Law in our Mid-States region, and we focus on data privacy, data sharing, and general public health authority work. We were created by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to promote and support the use of law and solve public health problems. Next slide, please. So to advance the F criteria, it's essential to address law, since law governs every aspect of data, including, as we know, its collection, use, disclosure, and protection. A law may be a friend. For example, a law establishes public health agencies and grants them power to collect data to protect the public during routine times and emergencies, including deciding the data elements and the formatting needed. Public health also has the power to require reporting of data by race and ethnicity, including by subgroups, that better reflect the history, language, and culture of populations than those that are captured by the OMB categories, which I know is something that folks have talked about on these calls in the last few weeks. Next slide, please. So as folks on the task force know, for most data reporting, we have a decentralized system with state law establishing reporting requirements. And this decentralized system is based on the US Constitution, which generally vests police powers. The police power is the power to regulate for the public good, safety, and health of the community. And so that is at the state level. And so state law determines in most instances who must report, what information must be reported, and which format and manner of reporting. And the resulting variations among states and territories, and even within the same jurisdiction with respect to different data, makes it difficult to coordinate data. This has presented problems in the context of immunization information systems. For example, IIS, as folks on this call know, are generally opt-in or opt-out. And this presents issues where providers or IIS wish to transmit immunization data across jurisdictional boundaries, such as through the IC gateway, where a state requires an express consent before its IIS may enter data. This presents problems when providers in other jurisdictions, particularly in opt-out jurisdictions, are not required to obtain a consent and certainly don't obtain an express consent to enter data into a neighboring jurisdiction's IIS. And so the IIS jurisdiction in that scenario that has requirements for express consent then encounters legal barriers to entering data because of their state law. Next slide, please. So I wanted to just spend a few minutes talking about minimum necessary. I know this is something that this group has talked about in the last few weeks, and particularly in the context of electronic case reporting, which was the subject of a previous task force meeting. One key difficulty in standardizing systems for national application from a legal perspective is the variation in law and policy among the states. Minimum necessary and how it's applied is a perfect example. And just as a reminder for folks, minimum necessary is a standard that's contained within HIPAA, within the privacy rule, and generally requires that a covered entity that is using or disclosing or requesting protective health information use the minimum necessary that is required to accomplish the intended use. And actually it applies to business associates as well. So covered entities and business associates. It applies in all, in some, but not all instances in which a covered entity discloses data. It does apply in the context of public health reporting, but a covered entity may rely on the representation of a public health authority as to what is the minimum necessary. And many, but not all, state health departments are HIPAA covered entities. Some jurisdictions have encountered problems in the application of the minimum necessary standard to trigger codes for reportable diseases. As we know, exactly which conditions are reportable and which data elements are reportable vary across jurisdictions. And where a disease or condition is not reportable in a jurisdiction, some of these jurisdictions have determined that receiving data about these conditions, and most importantly about patients, would be more than the minimum necessary. And whether or not that information would be more than minimum necessary, I think, is debatable. Some jurisdictions, for example, include a catch-all provision for unusual cases of a disease or a condition not otherwise listed in the jurisdiction's reporting law. And in those jurisdictions, I think it's very questionable as to whether it would be more than the minimum necessary to submit data on an unenumerated disease or condition. Nevertheless, the Reportable Conditions Knowledge Management System, the RCKMS, which one of the previous panelists spoke about during our conversation about electronic case reporting, and which is hosted on the AIMS platform, can determine the reportability of an initial case report and to which public health jurisdiction the initial case report would be sent. So that's one way in which technology can help overcome legal barriers and may help resolve questions around minimum necessary. And another way, I think, in which minimum necessary questions might be resolved is for ONC to work with the Office of Civil Rights, which is the agency that enforces HIPAA, to issue some guidance around this. Next slide, please. And then just with the time that I have left, I'll just briefly mention the information blocking rule. And that is a rule which also stems from the 21st Century Cures Act in response to concerns that some individuals or entities are engaging in practices that unreasonably limit the availability and use of electronic health information for authorized and permitted purposes. It prohibits healthcare providers and health IT developers of certified health IT and HIEs and HINs from engaging in activity that is likely to interfere with access, exchange, or use of electronic health information. ONC issued one frequently asked question, taking the position that a healthcare provider who fails to transmit data to public health where he's required to do so may be engaging in information blocking. And it may be helpful to have additional guidance from ONC on how the information blocking rule applies to transmission of data to public health, or even, again, work with the Office of Civil Rights to provide guidance for entities that are subject to both HIPAA and the information blocking rule, again, in the context of transmission of data to public health. So with that, I'll pass it back to you, Jillian, or Arian.
Great. Thank you so much. I think Arian has his hand up, but I think there's a question in the chat. For you, Stephen, if you could just speak briefly on how the minimum necessary applies to the uncovered portions of a hybrid entity.
Yeah, good question. So a hybrid is a certain type of covered entity in which the activities, and it often applies to a public health department where you have parts of the entity that would be subject to HIPAA if they were a separate legal entity and parts that would not be. And so in the context of a health department, we see this where you might have delivery of healthcare services, maybe in the community, and that might put you into the category of a covered entity. And so in the context of a hybrid, then you can parse out those parts of your covered entity and kind of wall them off. I know many people on the call know this already, but let's just cover some basics. So that is kind of the context of a hybrid. And so then those other parts of the hybrid, maybe your surveillance units or your WIC program or what have you, those then are not subject to HIPAA. So as to minimum necessary, it's part of the HIPAA privacy rule, and that means that it applies to covered entities and business associates. And so if you do not have a healthcare component involved, then really minimum necessary does not apply. Now, I would say that just with the caveat that keep in mind that, you know, when there's a disclosure of protected health information, you have two ends, you know, you have the sending party and the receiving party. And so you might have a covered entity on either side of that equation, which can add a certain nuance to it. But I guess the bottom line would be minimum necessary does not apply to non-healthcare components in a hybrid entity. And so if there's more detail that folks want to communicate about that specific problem, I'd be happy to address those too.
I know from in my former role in Massachusetts overseeing surveillance for infectious diseases, you know, we were really struggling with how we parse in certain pieces of information that might be coming through from electronic case. On electronic case reports, like around, you know, getting someone's mental health diagnosis associated with their hepatitis A, you know, case report, I just personally felt incredibly uncomfortable with capturing that information in our surveillance system. And so I know that they were working really, you know, hard to try to parse that information out. So I think that, you know, even though, you know, Massachusetts was a hybrid entity and we were on the uncovered side of it, I guess, if you will, excuse my lay terms language, you know, that doesn't mean that we should be collecting those pieces of information about an individual. And we always try to stick with the minimal necessary for what it is that we are investigating.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jillian. And I think something else to remember, like in that context, the example that you use with mental health is HIPAA is just one privacy law, and there are many others. And state law, you know, often has protections around mental health or in addition to the federal substance use privacy part two, there are also state provisions around that too. And in the context of surveillance as well, you know, you have confidentiality provisions around different data types like STI and HIV. And so, you know, people, I guess, need to get out of the mindset that it's just kind of like HIPAA is just the floor, as we like to say. And so I think we need to think beyond just HIPAA as to kind of the broader context.
Thank you. Arian.
There we go. There's the mute button. Thank you. No, yes, I was searching in vain for the mute button. So we have a little conversation going on in chat, but I just want to the heart of this of the minimum necessary issue in my mind, and this came up early days in the COVID pandemic and continues to be an issue, is that a covered entity, in particular a hospital provider, et cetera, who may want to provide data to a public health authority, may want to provide, for example, the full CCDA to a public health authority, is in legitimate doubt as to whether they are following the law or not. The situation where a public health authority, a local public health authority, a state, locality, et cetera, provides guidance that the full USCDI or US core data or whatever the appropriate subset, that is the subset that the EHR technology that the provider uses is medical minimum necessary, effectively has no issue. The issue arises when the local public health authority has not provided that uniform guidance. There is no uniform guidance coming from HHS OCR. And so there's no strong presumption that the format and content that an EHR can readily produce is in fact minimum necessary for public health disclosure. So I wonder whether you have recommendations, or you know, the notion that we talked about in the Duke Margolis work group task force was whether OCR, as you know, could provide some uniform guidance. If you have some perspective on what the form of that uniform guidance could be, and then the other thing that could be useful is NPHL providing and did actually provide a uniform guidance statement that was readily available language that a state or locality could adopt. And promote through their local authority. I'm not sure how much uptake there was in that standard language. And so maybe the question is, how can we better promote the issuance of uniform guidance that creates a presumption that the format and content that EHRs can readily produce for summaries of care is in fact minimum necessary when requested by a public health authority?
Yeah, that's a great point, Arian, and a few thoughts on that. One would be, you know, I should have started this conversation by saying that I obviously encourage everybody to talk to their legal counsel. What I present here, you know, is informational and it's not legal guidance. I am an attorney, but I'm not everybody's attorney on this call. Mm-hmm. But I know that some folks have the luxury of having legal counsel and some folks do not. I mean, in some smaller health departments, they do not. I have used that process myself of issuing like standard language that can be distributed to folks that are resisting reporting information. And we have distributed that just in the form of a letter. Before I was at the network, I was at the Chicago Department of Public Health. And sometimes that letter helps. One of the points that I want to emphasize with the minimum necessary is that, you know, the privacy rule states that a covered entity may rely on the representation of a health department or a health authority, as a public health authority, as it's referred to in HIPAA, as to what is the minimum necessary. And that is the rule. So to my understanding, you know, as a lawyer, that kind of creates a safe harbor or a safe haven for a covered entity that, you know, you can legitimately rely on the representations of a health department as to what is the minimum necessary. I don't see a reason why OCR could not issue some guidance, and perhaps ONC could work together with OCR to do that. Because I think it is something where there's a gray area, but I think there is some certainty in it. I mean, this, you know, the fact that you can rely on representation of the public health department, that does create some reliability, you know, so that I know you mentioned, Arian, that hospitals or other private entities might have legitimate concerns, and they are legitimate, but again, you know, if you have a representation from a health department that, you know, these are the minimum necessary, you know, the USCDI data points are minimum necessary, then that is legitimate. I mean, that is enough to say that, yes, yeah, this is the minimum necessary.
So I just want to follow up on that because, you know, I think Chicago was an exemplary public health department that issued proactive guidance and created, you know, not just a reasonable presumption, but a letter, a referenceable letter that clearly addressed the question of minimum necessary. It is my opinion, and I'm looking for, you know, maybe your perspective on this, that if, as you know, if ONC could collaborate with OCR, to note that if a public health department, a public health authority requests data in a certain format, according to the readily produced information that's mapped back to public standards, to national standards like USCDI, that in fact, that act itself constitutes a declaration that data is indeed minimum necessary for the use requested. I think that simple kind of guidance from OCR would help a lot in addressing some of the legitimate concerns that a hospital or provider organization might reasonably have.
I want to just step in here for a second and just caution it against, you know, what version we're talking about with USCDI, because it is at this point woefully, it's not enough for public health right now. And I think, you know, we're starting to try to address some of that with version 4, but we are a long way from implementation. So if we just reference, you know, USCDI version 1, we're not going to be getting the information that we need. Aaron, we've got a lot of people with their hands up. So beginning with you, Aaron.
I mean, I think you just addressed it. We talk sometimes about USCDI as this kind of like monolithic standard, but there are versions and I think different expectations for the implementation of those versions. And they we also have USCDI plus. And so I would question and caution whether or not any one version, at least now as currently designed and implemented, would support minimum necessary for public health.
Thank you. I agree. Bryant?
Yeah, I just want to underline and ask Stephen to confirm it is not HHS or the OCR that ultimately determines. You know, we worked with our assistant attorney general in Washington State, and it's at the state authority, or in our particular state, it's actually a home rule. It's the local jurisdictions that ultimately determine what the minimum necessary is. And the state is acting on behalf of the local jurisdictions. So I caution you to think that we could come up with one generic guidance that would cover cover the entire country in terms of what is needed to respond to a particular on the ground outbreak or on the ground health situation, because it may not be a pandemic that we're dealing with now, which I would argue if, you know, did give us a uniform need, but there may be situations that we paint ourselves into a corner if we say that it has to be consistent across the entire country in terms of understanding what the data elements are. USCDI can't predict the data elements that might be, you know, hidden or necessary in a physician's note. And if we go back to the old days, what happened with a case investigation is shoe leather epidemiology. those epidemiologists and the health officer from a jurisdiction would go into the clinic or into the hospital, open up the chart and review everything to determine what needed to be pulled forward into the case investigation. We need the digital equivalent of that. We're partners in this response. And as our attorney general said, we're part of the healthcare team that's seeking to respond to this crisis. We're not, you know, a government entity that's just creating a lineless tally. We're part of the response. Over.
That's a great point. I think it's important to remember that minimum necessary is a very flexible standard. And as you say, Brian, it's not going to be the same from one place to the next. I think, you know, one thing that I haven't mentioned, you know, I think folks on this call already know, but, you know, the provision within HIPAA that permits disclosure of protected health information to a public health authority is pretty broad. It can be frustratingly vague at times, but at the same time, it does permit public health authority to, or rather a covered entity to disclose protected health information to a public health authority authorized by law to receive the information for a slew of public health reasons. And, you know, that gets us into the minimum necessary, but, you know, we have that advantage of having that provision within HIPAA that does permit disclosure to public health. So I think we have a bit of a leg up in many respects. I guess, yeah, that's where we land then in terms of determining what the minimum necessary is from one place to the next.
Hans.
Excuse me. I would like to echo a little bit of what Aaron mentioned, that UCDI, that we have to be careful looking at that. And in fact, that even today's version one in some areas is not enough, and in other areas it's too much. And when you look at it, at the individual data classes in there, it's not the entire data class in all the instances. There are certain lab tests that are included, but not others necessarily. So it really varies, and I would be very careful using CDI or even using CDI plus to really understand minimum necessary and the variations. Rather, I think we need to start to look at the methods that's starting to be used around case reporting with the RCKMS, the knowledge management capability. How can we capture that guidance across jurisdictions in a very consistent, non-English in a way, but very structured, computable way, that we can capture that so that there's clarity who is required to report what. And that, where we ground that to understand that USCDI effectively is a scoping mechanism to say, for this set of data, we know that there are standards in CCDA, in FHIR, and perhaps in some areas over time as well. But therefore, we know it can be done in a standard fashion. The combination between that and an RCKMS style approach that looks at what is reportable at the trigger of an event, whatever the event might be, very granular, very coarse, whatever. And what are some of the requirements that when you query follow up, which is much more dynamic, so it might not be as applicable, is that I think that's where we need to look to help scope and define and understand what's necessary. UCDI is a great tool for general scoping, but it is too blunt of a tool to get into the refined understanding that we need to have to address minimum necessary by jurisdiction.
Thanks, Hans. Really good points. I also just want to draw your attention to the example that Aaron gave in the chat of the fungal meningitis outbreak that actually occurred in Tennessee. That is a really good example of a local need for flexibility around information. Steve, I see your hand. Oh, you're next, Stephen. So take it away. Sorry.
Thank you. I got 3 points. I want to echo what Brian said earlier regarding local control or local government or state government levels of activities, that it may not be sufficient to have something just from OCR, because there may be state regulations that apply that may be different in that space, and getting weigh-in from either state's attorney general or department counsel or whatever is the right authority for that particular environment really is important. Secondly, I think as we're looking at a minimum necessary set, it depends really on the purpose behind my data collection. I may need a different minimum set of data for, say, birth defects registry as I might for immunization. And I don't necessarily want extraneous information because I have to account for that. If I store it and I don't need it, it's an unnecessary storage, which is increasing my cost and increasing the risk of that data being released for unintended purposes and not really respecting individuals with their privacy and security components. So we do have to be cognizant of that as well. And thirdly, I'm not sure that the US CDI is the right data set to define it. We really do need flexibility to address what is the minimum necessary for that particular purpose. Public health is not in a good position to simply receive a CDA from health, from a provider and say, okay, public health, you figure out what you're supposed to do with this and where you're supposed to populate the different registries or different uses of that data. That runs into the dangerous world of having missing data or interpreting what is the data really used for. We have different data needs for, say, cancer registry and immunization. And if we're trying to have a single message that fulfills all needs, then it means that each field would have to be populated for each message to satisfy that minimum necessary for all those uses. So we really need to be careful about where we're going in this space. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. And our other Steve.
Yeah, we in other task forces, we've made me Stephen and him Steve or Ike, but we can okay. do whatever we need. I just wanted to bring attention to some information that I put into the chat. So early on in the COVID-19 pandemic, at Care Quality, we developed a policy trying to address this that basically said that we were happy to utilize queries that were made, that were labeled as being made for treatment purposes in order to address public health needs. And we got that approved by the participants of the Care Quality Framework. We also said and encouraged public health jurisdictions or states to specify that a query for a CCD could be assumed to be minimum necessary in the context of the pandemic. And we stood that up. And as Bryant points out, we actually did utilize that in at least one case. I'm checking to see if and there are any others that availed themselves of that. That we thought was a good solution, but I was impressed by how little opportunity was made of that. I think the beauty of the progression towards FHIR, one of the beauties is that it addresses exactly this problem. And I agree, Stephen, that Stephen Murphy, that you know that FHIR, we don't need to use FHIR for everything. We don't just assume it's the right answer. But I think in this case, for queries from public health to providers, it is a great answer, specifically because we know providers have FHIR capabilities in order to respond. And in this way, a specified query can be made, and then a declaration by the jurisdiction can simply say that, you know, if we're asking for it using FHIR, that is the minimum necessary. And I don't think we need to keep going back and revisiting that. So I do hope that that's a direction that we'll be going in.
I do appreciate that point, but I cannot stress enough that public health may not have the capacity and the resources to send and receive FHIR right away. There are some health departments and state health departments that definitely do have that capability, but there are others that are really under-resourced and simply do not have that capability on the ground. So we have to make sure that we build in flexibility to both support the higher performing and the more and what we would like to aspire to, as well as what is actually reality on the ground.
Aaron, well, I guess, Gillian, actually, before you go on, if I could just say a question to Stephen as the attorney in the room. Is this a concept that a public health jurisdiction could state that a CCD request is minimum necessary for our purposes? Is that a reasonable idea as we move beyond a declared pandemic? And in fact, was it even a reasonable idea when we proposed it back in 2020?
I think yes. I mean, you know, going back to my point about the fact that a covered entity can rely on the representation of a public health department, and I think as long as it's reasonable, I think, you know, I don't foresee an issue with that.
Yeah, and our and Stephen, our attorney, our assistant attorney general, specifically consulted with the Network for Public Health Law in crafting the position and crafting the letter from our state health officer that allowed for that query. But it's still, you know, I think that Jillian put it really well, like even a high functioning state like Washington still can struggle with the variety of responses that come back. No two CDAs are formatted exactly alike, or oftentimes a customized implementation will put certain data elements into some places and not others. So it becomes a tremendous challenge for public health to utilize that information effectively. And if a state like Washington is struggling with it, I can only imagine what states that have been even in greater underfunded are dealing with. So I think we, maybe part of our recommendations need to be providing that technical assistance, those regional extension centers, to lift up all of the capacity of the catcher's mitt components that Mickey Tripathi talked about when they put forward this charge.
Thanks. And Brian, actually, I just want to go back to a point you made, I think, a few minutes ago about in your jurisdiction, you said that it's the local health department that determines the minimum necessary. And is that codified somewhere or?
Yeah, at home, we're in a home rule state. The public health authority in Washington state is a county or health district. We have several multi-county consortiums that have a single health officer within a multi-county region. They have the authority in our state constitution for public health response. The state public health agency works under their behalf to gather information.
Thank you.
All right. I want to make sure Erin gets a chance to say a word, and then we're probably going to need to move over to the worksheet. So, Arian?
Yeah. I feel like sometimes we're talking ourselves into circles in this conversation. Clearly, if a state or locality public health authority provides legal guidance, legally enforceable guidance, that does constitute minimum necessary, and nobody argues with that. Number two, the mention of USCDI is purely because USCDI constrains the boundaries of what is readily producible by an EHR. And again, nobody disputes the ability of a public health authority to ask or request in electronic means for more than is in USCDI, but USCDI does provide the boundary envelope for what is readily producible. And it's going to provide the boundary and envelope for where the floor exists. And then really the third point is that if we come to the conclusion that fire is the, you know, a scalpel, something like fire is the right tool for public health to use, but public health can't use fire and the USCDI doesn't provide the data that public health needs, what we're doing is talking ourselves into a world where we're really maintaining status quo, and that's great if we like status quo. So maybe a little more frustration than helpful commentary. Where I was trying to steer towards was steering towards a land where we have uniform guidance from OCR, which independent of public health authorities does administer HIPAA, and administers HIPAA penalties and penalties for disclosure. A guidance from OCR that if a public health authority asks for something, that request itself is by definition minimum necessary for the data that's being requested. And it does seem to me that in the absence of more specific guidance or legal ruling from a public health authority, that having OCR provide that higher level guidance would be useful for covered entities that have some reasonable uncertainty. That's the proposal that I'm making. If that's not a proposal that the work group feels is helpful, we can just punt on this issue and move on. But I do caution us not to drive ourselves to a world where we rule out everything that's possible and only accept the impossible, because then we'll be in the world that we currently are.
You know, Arian, that's kind of where my mind was going too, that, you know, as we talk about local health departments and state health departments making determinations as to what is minimum necessary, and you used the phrase like legally enforceable guidance, the first thing that came to mind for me was, you know, at the end of the day for a covered entity, it's OCR that's going to decide whether they're playing by the rules or not. And to be honest, you know, we see enforcement actions from OCR every month. It kind of ebbs and flows. Some years there's like one every month, and then other times there's not. You know, I haven't seen, I can't think of an enforcement action off the top of my head involving minimum necessary. And not to say that OCR couldn't come down hard on it. They could. I mean, they make a very big deal out of the right to access, which, you know, they invest a lot of resources in. So I guess they could invest resources in this too. You know, a lot of times the enforcement actions are far more egregious mishaps around HIPAA compliance.
I'm going to give John the last word while we switch over. Liz, perhaps you can get ready the worksheet for us.
John? Thank you, Jillian. Just looking from Stephen Murphy's perspective on a lesson learned from the pandemic response, which returning to public health authorities' broad but vague authority in many states, not just mine, where I run a health information exchange, public health authorities wanted to leverage the HIE as an aggregator of data. And they asked, the public health authority asked, for example, hospitals to report through the health information exchange. And the interpretation of many hospitals was, we can't, they aren't a public health authority. So in our state, that required a governor's executive order, which was followed by a change to state law before the executive order expired. Was this a weird policy barrier that was encountered because it was perceived as fairly common when we spoke to our peers in other states?
That's very interesting. And, you know, I think in terms of public health authority, I mean, it does vary from one jurisdiction to the next in terms of what authority is granted to a local health department versus what's retained by the state. Some jurisdictions are centralized to a state health department. Some are very decentralized. Some jurisdictions have home rule authority. Other municipalities and cities and counties operate under different kinds of authority. So I think it's going to depend on the facts, which I know it's an answer that attorneys love to give, but people don't generally like to hear it. But I think it would depend on the authority that we're talking about in any particular instance. I mean, the city of Chicago is going to have different public health authority than the state of Ohio or, you know, what have you. So how's that for sitting on the fence, John?
Nice. Unfortunately, yeah, that kind of confirms what I thought. Thank you.
Nice. Clear as something. Cool. All right, let us go over to, so first of all, just thanks to the presenters. You're welcome to stay on as we go through the sausage making of taking this input and turning it into recommendations, transmittal to the national coordinator. But if that doesn't constitute entertainment for you, you're also welcome to drop and get on with your day. But again, profound appreciations for the input and the feedback and the engagement. So, Jillian, you had a question on the status of the transmittal, and so maybe we can start with a framing conversation about what the transmittal is and what its role is.
Yeah, it was more just, I just want to make sure that everybody's clear about what the process is going to be and the parameters around which comments will be made.
Cool. So let me give. Let me give a broad overview of what it is that we produce. So at the end of the day, as a task force of the HRT advisory committee, we produce a draft transmittal. That transmittal is effectively a letter from the high tech to the national coordinator that makes certain recommendations. At the end of the day, it's the high tech as a full deliberative body that passes or doesn't that transmittal on to the national coordinator. There's clearly a presumption that the work group that has engaged in this work and that our recommendations are good and strong. But at the end of the day, it is the high tech that is making the determination to pass the transmittal on to the national coordinator. As I noted, the transmittal is a set of recommendations to the national coordinator, and so we may make appropriate recommendations for the national coordinator to convene with other federal agencies, but it's not our role to make recommendations to CDC, to other federal agencies, or to other entities, including STILTS, about what they should do. The term that we generally use is, we recommend that ONC coordinate with or convene or, use one of its powers, one of its coordination powers to be able to affect some indirect action on other actors. In terms of the process, we're using the spreadsheet as the input mechanism. So it's a more free-ranging, free-floating place to collect our ideas. And then we memorialize those in the draft transmittal. That draft transmittal is draft until we lock it and present it to the high tech, and the high tech makes any amendments that they might make on it, and it moves on. So moving something from the worksheet to the transmittal letter does not finalize that content until we actually do finalize and send it on to the high tech for consideration. We just have a lot more flexibility for drafting and editing in the worksheet as opposed to drafting in the transmittal. So when we're in the transmittal mode, we like to keep the content locked down and then use the comment feature to make suggested changes. We will definitely go through the transmittal line by line and make sure that it represents the notion of the work group. So, Jillian, any other sort of high level feedback in terms of the process that we're using?
No, I don't think so. Liz, did we cover all of the parameters?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
I just want to add one thing on the disposition working document. You will all be getting a link to the disposition working document with this week's homework email, but it you'll have reviewer access. So that's the suggesting mode in Google Document so that we can capture comments as we go through. Jillian and Arian, anything that had been green in the worksheet has been transferred over. So anything that's color-coded green going forward, we won't, we'll be able to make edits on in the draft disposition working document.
Yeah, so for task force members, if you encounter something that is green in the spreadsheet and you disagree with it, it's not going to be useful to register that disagreement in the spreadsheet itself. Please move over to the draft transmittal and provide a comment to that effect. So trying to make that actionable for you. Cool. Why don't we go back over we didn't quite get through all the overarching comments. So why don't we go through overarching and let's scroll past the stuff that we've, scroll to the uncovered items. Okay, Jillian.
So this is just sort of a general statement, and I have conferred with colleagues, and we would like to make sure that wherever it said stakeholders, that public health and stakeholders, that we update that to state STLT public health authorities and their partner organizations, and there that gets at the point that you addressed by bringing in SD, ERA, and APHL and others.
Perfect. So we're going to use still public health authorities and their partner organizations as our generic term. It's long. It's long, but it's at least we can copy and paste. And it is unambiguous. And we'll make sure to define it upfront in the transmittal.
Yeah, I propose that we just when we don't need to go back everywhere within this document. We'll just bring it over for language in the
transmittal. Yeah, that's right. When we transmit over it, when we put it over to the transmittal, we will make sure to be using that term consistently. Okay, Kansky.
Yeah, thanks. So this is actually a really good juxtaposition to the issue I just raised with Stephen Murphy. Aaron, you crafted a articulate row 5 recommendation, which I totally support, that refers to making sure that intermediaries, that there's flexibility given. This, I believe, is related but different. And it acknowledges that there are state-based small P and large P policy barriers. Ike and Bryant referenced a couple of these in their comments. And that, of course, gets to the, what do you want? What do you think we should do about it? My question is whether there would be support for a recommendation regarding ONC offering guidance on these policy barriers, noting perhaps what best practice is or barriers to avoid. I don't know, interested in whether there's support for that.
Yeah, maybe CDC could offer advice to Stilts on what policies Stilts should use. Sorry, that was tongue firmly in cheek as the suggestion least likely to be adopted. Jillian, looking for your guidance in terms of, this is an area where what I want to say is that accepting and acknowledging that public health authority resides by constitution in our federalist system in states and localities, and accepting and understanding that public health authority is broad and jurisdictional. Nonetheless, there are certain ways of using public health authority and associated policy that are useful, and some that are not useful. So saying that something is not useful is certainly not saying that a state or locality does not have the right to engage in that activity. Those are two different determinations. All that being said, Jillian, what would be the right recommendation, if any, to make recommendations in that help that help public health authorities achieve their mission while reducing the process-oriented or policy-oriented friction towards mission achievement? And is that an ONC role?
I don't know that that is an ONC role, but I think that there could be general acknowledgement that these authorities do exist at the state and local level, but wherever possible, public health should come together to develop consensus and speak with a unified voice.
And so again, we're our goal is to make recommendations to ONC. So the way we might want to frame that is we recommend that ONC confer with, convene. Yeah. Okay.
And I would offer that you can certainly focus this. My intent, what I'm thinking of, you can certainly focus this by addressing the intermediary issues. You want to give public health authority the ensure that they have the flexibility to leverage intermediaries when it makes sense. And the policy barriers are often unintended, but I'm trying to narrow it to make it more actionable. It's really the use of intermediaries to accomplish these public health missions that I'm referring to.
I just want to point you to the comment that Aaron made in the chat.
Yeah, and I was about to respond to that. There's a distinction between an EDI engine that a public health authority deploys in order to meet their local mission, and the use of an intermediary that serves multiple parties. A multi-tenant intermediary. So APHL AIMS platform would be an example of a multi-tenant intermediary. A single tenant component that is used for by a state or locality to achieve its public health mission would not be in that frame an intermediary. But as we get to a next generation architectural vision for public health data infrastructure, we may well be relying on multi-tenant infrastructure to better support Stilts in achieving their mission. And this position becomes much more salient. And then as, you know, as John's noting, there's a significant need for other intermediaries that may be state-based, like a state HIE, national intermediaries that provide nationwide query networks, such as QHINs. This position is pretty salient. I think we've got good guidance. So Jillian, maybe you and I can work on turning this into actionable recommendations text.
Adrian, I want to jump in really quickly. One of my concerns about intermediaries is who then ends up with rights to data through that intermediary for what purpose? People don't usually have an opportunity to opt into public health reporting or opt out of public health reporting for contagious diseases and the like. People should have a right to not participate in health information exchange.
No doubt.
I want to clarify, there's no issue in data being routed through an intermediary to public health. We just need to be careful about what retention rights exist for that intermediary.
No doubt. So there should also be no presumption that a public health authority must use an intermediary that does not address the policy goals of the public health authority. All right, let's move on to the next unmarked issue.
Arian, I think you may be oversimplifying that multi-tenant concept in that when an intermediary is operated by an organization like APHL and on behalf of the states, but the funding for that infrastructure comes from a federal agency, who has that ultimate retention or data governance and access? I think we went through an evolution of this with syndromic surveillance, where we had a multi-tenant structure that each state governed its own data. And it, cost savings reasons, became a non-multi-tenant environment operated by the feds. And that begets problems that were unforeseen by the policy its origin. So I think we need to not oversimplify this.
Just to be clear, nothing that we're saying is making any recommendations on the use or non-use of intermediaries. All we are saying is that in the context of this transmittal is that the certification criteria and any use of those certification criteria be flexible to allow public health authorities to assemble the technology to achieve the public health mission, and that does include multiple modalities of use. So, I think it would be
allow but not require.
So if you go back and look at the language that I drafted, please go back and make sure. I think it does address all those concerns. But please go back and relook at that language and make sure that it does indeed address those concerns. We can go back at the end as we have time and go back and look at the proposed language because I did try to write it that way. Okay. So I said we just marked Jillian's comment as already addressed.
This was a different one, actually. Okay. This was around developing use cases to reflect real world testing and having it be done through consensus within public health and establishment of a minimum threshold.
Okay. So this would want to go along with our general recommendations that certification address not just not just syntax, but also semantics, and that there be no gap between certification and in the wild interoperability. So,
right, and not just the perfect, but also the imperfect.
Yep. Good. So I think we can take this language, move it over, and then I think we're going to have to do an editing pass just to make sure all the language reads together. I think it follows as a natural extension, some of the stuff that's already in there.
Quick question there, Aaron, Jillian, particularly Jillian. Do we need to have some consideration in that recommendation on how to or whether to address the variations? Because certification today is a singular set across all jurisdictions, and then we have all jurisdictions having variations. So I'm trying to understand, are you trying to indicate this is only the real-world testing at the level of certification that currently exists nationally, or that there be that recognition of variations that need to be recognized and so in such real-world testing?
I guess, Hans, my take, and Jillian's free to completely disagree with this, my take would be we want to make sure that the floor level of interoperability actually is sufficient to meet the floor level of public health mission. And what we've heard in practice on the ground is that the floor level of interoperability is defined by certified standards, does not in fact address the needs that were for which those floor level certification criteria and implementation guidance were developed, oftentimes because the data that's flowing through those interfaces is not in fact the data that was represented to flow through those interfaces. Jillian, does that, or do you have a different perspective there in terms of addressing variation above the floor?
I think that I am agreeing with you. I think what we don't want to just be looking at, you know, I think what my point was that we don't want to just be looking at the ideal message that are coming through, which most certification programs currently look for, but we also want to be able to assess what it means when they're missing data elements that are there, or that their people are using non-compliant value sets.
Exactly.
So that would be at the minimum standard.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And that's good clarity, because that was not totally clear as to, are you looking for the real world of the minimum, both sides of good data, bad data, everything, or beyond the minimum for the variations in jurisdictions as well.
We want the floor to actually work.
Yep.
Yes.
Because some of the issues may be not so much the data being sent from or to public health, but looking at how the data is translated from within the EHR to the outgoing message, if that makes.
Yeah, no. So oftentimes what happens in practice is that the certification run that an EHR goes through is 100% happy path, mocked up data, everything's entered new, everything follows the existing, you know, the required coding standards. And then you send it out into the real world and you've got legacy codes, you've got people loading in non-compliant code sets, you've got people using the EHR in ways that were not contemplated in the certification test script. And so the data that flows out of the EHR does not actually conform to what was certified to. And we want to reduce that level of variance.
Right, exactly.
Yep, okay. Okay. Sorry, I'm doing my initial dereferencing and trying to figure out who JG is.
It's Joe Gibson from CDPC Foundation.
Got it. Thank you, Joe.
Sure. These are two kind of related recommendations, and it's about putting some focus beyond the interface between healthcare and public health to looking at transmission within public health and from public health to other partners who are going to use the information. So recommending that require that the systems have some functionality for transmitting subsets of the data within two other public health agencies. And then the next one is about specifically immunizations. There's a lot of partners who can make use of immunization data and making sure that that interoperability is considered in certifying the systems.
I generally agree with the sentiment. My only concern is that our charter is F criteria, EHR catchers, potential public health data receivers, and intermediaries. And so this would be pushing on our charter a bit, which doesn't mean we can't make the recommendation, but we probably would want to acknowledge that it is strictly extra to our charter.
Yeah, I didn't realize that limitation, but it's sort of getting to the meaningful use of the data.
Yep. Any comment in terms of making these recommendations that we also address, other consumers in the case, for example, of immunization registry or other public health authorities in the case of upstream downstream use of data. Not seeing any major dissent. Let's move on. Did we miss one, Liz? There we go. One up. There we go. So also you, Joe.
Oh yeah, so this is somewhat similar to the prior one. This is more specific to the uses of immunization data.
Got it.
Uses.
Cool. Good, good, good. Okay.
Yeah, filtering is not doing what it's supposed to do, so I've highlighted the next overarching one.
Okay.
This is another one of mine.
Okay.
Looking also to improve content and assessing compliance and recommending development of new testing tools.
Okay, so we should put this in that same section. As I said, we're gonna have to do an editing pass just to make sure it all reads well together. Okay, so are we all the way through overarching? Oh, we got more overarching, nice, as you say. So I think we've addressed this one. I'm gonna see if we can mark this one as a duplicate.
So this is a little different. I actually just updated it based on the conversation that we just had. I think it's going to be critical for public health and other partners, frankly, to be able to incorporate a combination of technology solutions internal to their organization. And I would, so I updated that here in this recommendation.
No, I think it is a duplicate of the modular certification recommendation, or it may be an extension of that modular certification criteria recommendation, the number of which currently eludes me. But we can why don't we move it over, and then we can do an editing pass and just combine like with like, and see what we can do to deduplicate any duplication.
But I think, Arian, I think modular certification presumes that the parent product is under the ONC governance, and it may be that an EDI engine may be outside of the healthcare industry tool set and will have no goal or interest in seeking certification.
Yeah.
So there is no modular certification that will ever happen. So I think that there needs to be some recognition.
The general means for solving that problem is a self-certification approach, where if a state or locality, if a stilt is assembling COTS technology to address the issue, and that COTS technology or that assembly of COTS technology needs to be certified, that there needs to be a path for self-certification of the assembled technology.
Yeah, but there is not a, unlike the healthcare side, there is no financial incentive or return on investment for that certification. So there's some sustainability challenges there.
Right, and again, I think our presumption broadly, and we have a recommendation to this effect, is that As we require, as we include certification requirements in programmatics, that we also contemplate the funding associated with achieving certification. But yes, I think this one also belongs in that same section. So let's mark it, move it over, and then just make sure that the same overarching recommendation that's there is accommodative of this nuance as well. All right, Phil. Is Phil on?
I'm here. Hi, Arian.
Hey.
Yep, so this is basically a recommendation for ONC to coordinate with CMS and SAMHSA on defining and incentivizing certified HIT outside of...
I think this is outside of our scope, unless you can convince me that it fits the scope definition that we have for looking at at public health criteria, or are you making the recommendation that that non-certified? Are you making the recommendation that health information technology that is in use by organizations that are not currently covered by meaningful use or promoting interoperability also be certified to the public health standards? So for example, that an LTPAC could access immunization registry data or report on syndromic surveillance or transmit case reports. Is that the intent here?
That's correct. So,
good.
So enabling,
okay,
these alternative settings to use that technology to be able to report on the F criteria.
Got it. Okay, cool. So we just need to make sure that we limit this recommendation to appropriate F criteria. Then I think I understand and agree that it does fit part of our mission. Okay. All right, Liz, are we okay? Cool. We have gone through the overarching criteria. Let's see. I don't think we have a good way of marking currently whether something is filtered by color. Is filtered by color working? All right. Let's do as we have. We have 8 minutes, but we're going to reserve 5 of that for public comment. So we have 3 minutes. Let's go through as much as we can of the currently untagged. Okay, and Aaron.
Yeah, so the next series of items are all in regards to lab tests and results, but also included, there's also included some items regarding orders. And the approach I took with some of these was to include kind of setting a standard or a baseline certification criteria, but then also this notion of an advanced criteria, which would allow for entities who may be at a point where they could further adopt new or additional criteria, like adopting new laboratory specifications, for example, would have the ability to do so. And so this first one is specific to receivers of electronic laboratory results. And what's included are the implementation guide and all of the errata and clarification documentation as documented in the ISA, as well as the value set companion guide.
Okay, so we should have a consensus about how we address specific implementation guidance. Are we going to make comment on the specifics of implementation guidance that we expect to be in a certification program? Or make reference to the certification program itself. I think the way things stand, absent this recommendation, is that we're making recommendations that public health data systems be certified to the appropriate F criteria. We're also making recommendations that ONC work to update appropriate implementation guidance to the latest supported versions. And we're also making recommendations that that be done in ways that are consistent with deployed technology and public health funding. And you know, I think we have a choice about providing broad level policy guidance or providing specific policy guidance. And I would prefer that we sort of stick with a broad level policy framework as opposed to naming specific implementation guidance, but that perspective may well be disagreed with by the members of the task force, and I don't feel so strongly about that one that I'm that it's a point of religion for me. So my general perspective is that we should be providing a policy framework and giving ONC the flexibility to do the assessment, making pointers in areas where we recognize that there are updates, as we do, I think, for LRI, that there are updates in LRI that address some of the variations we've seen with ELR, likewise with some of the other standards. So anyway, just happy to, that's a perspective that I have, but happy to have a different perspective if the task force believes that this is, that we should be getting kind of into that level of detail. Bryant.
Yeah, Arianne, I think we are tasked as a task force with making recommendations, and the public health members of the task force recognize that ONC in a broad guidance hasn't gotten to the level of detail and specificity. So I think I contend we do need to get very specific, and mention specific standards or specific versions of or releases of standards if we're going to make some rapid response that we very well could have made in advance of the pandemic but didn't because
yep.
The guidance was generalized. I think we need to be specific, say you need to get to the bar, and I recognize that the dilemma there is that we'll have to come back and reconvene when new versions come out, but so be it. I think that's the cost of being impactful.
Yeah, we can do a both and, right? We can provide a broad level policy framework, and we can also make specific recommendations. So there's no conflict in doing a both and.
And particularly in this area, is that release R4 of LRI and LRI just were published. And they do address latest capabilities as well as that they have pre-adoption opportunities. And I think that makes it even more important to be more specific about the context and the framework to say in ELR, what is a reasonable way to mix and match or not, or and if you mix and match, which ones, to make sure that the path is as consistent as possible, because the amount of variation is already substantial. If we're going to put in more with the variety of guides that you can support or not support, it's going to make it more complicated. We have to keep it simple.
I gracefully withdraw. We have to go to public comment. So we will open it up for public comment.
All right. Hi, everyone. Can you guys hear me?
We got you.
All right. So we will transition to open up for public comment. If you are on the Zoom and would like to make a comment, please just use the raise hand function, which is located in the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, you could just press *9 to raise your hand. And then once called upon, you can press *6. To mute and unmute yourself. We'll pause for a minute and give folks a chance to get in queue if anyone has any public comments. Okay, no comments. So I will turn it back to Jillian and Arianne to close us out.
All right, so let's try to see if next week we can get through all of the untagged content and see if we can get to using the transmittal as our, by the week after, using the transmittal as our primary means of input. I think for homework, we'd like to ask folks to do, you know, in effect, a close to last call, because our time is very limited. Our next meeting is also going to be occupied by a public health systems developer forum. We're going to have a chance to hear from public health systems developers on their perspectives on certification. So we'll have a little bit of limited time in going through the commentary. We'll try to keep that session brisk. And then it's really, really crunch time. So, you know, for homework, we'd just encourage task force members to do last call for worksheet input. We'll go to the transmittal and clean the transmittal up to make sure that it represents the will of the task force in something that is clean and actionable for ONC to reference. And with that, I think we're 1 minute over, so we should end. And looking forward to next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks all.
Take care.
Thank you, everyone.